Okay, I give the floor to Wong Yi.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, members. In this session, we'd like to seek your views about forestry disclosure that the board already tentatively decided to consider, and secondly, additional possible disclosure the staff are considering to improve disclosure requirement for business combination, goodwill, and impairment. Finally, we would also like to ask whether you have any suggestions or new ideas for other improvements to disclosure for this research project. Page 5 of this paper briefly explains the background of this research project, and Appendix A provides a summary of tentative decision made by the board so far. Moving on to today's main topic, improving disclosures about business combinations, goodwill and impairment, which is covered from page 7 to 16. At each December 2017 meeting, the board tentatively decided to consider requiring the disclosure listed in page 8. A summary of the analysis of this disclosure are set out on pages from 9 to 11. And page 12 set out the additional possible disclosure the staff are further considering. They are based on the recent feedback from users, and this disclosure can help users to perform their own assessment about business combination. Brief analysis of these additional possible disclosure, including cost-benefit consideration, are set out on pages 13 to 15. And page 16 provides other possible additional disclosure from recent feedback. The staff will analyze these additional possible disclosure and present them to the board at a future meeting. Our question to you is on page 17. We welcome your comments and feedback. Thank you.
Rely on the Japanese. Thank you. Based on our interviews with Japanese analysts, we have also identified some analysts asked for additional disclosures, including the disaggregation of goodwill on a transaction-by-transaction basis. However, because the acquired business is oftentimes integrated with acquirer's business, so we think it would be difficult for an entity to track the amount of goodwill on a transaction-by-transaction basis. We also note that impairment will not necessarily be tested for goodwill on a transaction-by-transaction basis, and therefore the usefulness of information could be limited. Regarding other possible disclosures, some Japanese analysts mentioned that disclosures how management determines the timing of recognizing impairment, for example, how the business environment or management strategy has changed, and how such changes affect the input for the estimating the value of use would be useful. Andrew?
Thank you. It's very interesting to be talking about adding disclosures, given your later session today is talking about the standards level review of disclosures. I don't think we're advocating a complete moratorium on new disclosures, just a cautious approach overall. Looking at this morning's paper, there are two quite distinct disclosure objectives under consideration, one about helping users to understand whether the acquisition has been a success, and the other about adding rigour to the impairment test, or clarity to the impairment test, if I can put it that way. On the first one, has the acquisition been a success? We've heard the calls from users that that's what they really want to understand. And then the perennial response is, but that's very hard to do because the business, the acquiree, is integrated into the acquirer's business. I don't think there's any absolute truth on where the balance lies in that, because the facts and circumstances are always going to be different. But I think any disclosure in this area needs to be based on an objective, and there'll be different ways to meet the objective depending on the motivation for the acquisition, the extent and type of integration that's taken place. Sometimes one acquisition might be motivated just to, for example, obtain a piece of intellectual property, and the disclosures to evaluate whether that's been a good decision will be very different to a standalone type acquisition by a venture capital organisation that will leave the acquiry more or less as a single unit. So I think the types of disclosure around slide 9 here, yeah, basically saying what was your objective from the acquisition, how have things turned out compared to the assumptions that you made in pricing the acquisition, seem more appropriate as a sort of objective than giving a mandatory requiring a mandatory disclosure on revenue, operating profit for a specified post-acquisition period. I think on the disclosures around the goodwill and impairment test, you'd be surprised to hear, no doubt, that when EFRAG published its discussion paper mainly exploring possible improvements to the impairment test, we asked about disclosures. There wasn't much enthusiasm for additional disclosures, but that's probably not a great surprise. The goodwill, as Yukio said, the goodwill tracking, I think that would need to be very carefully cost-benefit tested and field-tested, because I've also heard that that's very complex to do, but keep an open mind on whether it's really that complex. I just think it needs to be tested. On the headroom disclosures, depending on how those were developed, what you had in mind, I mean, that could amount to disclosing the recoverable amount of CGUs or segments or the entire entity, if we're talking about goodwill that's only tested at corporate level. So disclosing the value of your segments or business seems a controversial thing to require, I'll put it that way.
Could I ask a question, or maybe it's more of a thought than a question?
Yeah.
In response to Andrew's comment. So I think you rightly said that there's a sort of balance to be struck here, in that there'll be places where the disclosure might be effective and places where it might not, and the integration is the obvious stumbling block to this. And I wonder if we should necessarily give up on something because it won't work well in some circumstances, and that it might be an improvement to have something that works in some cases, even if it doesn't work across the board, and maybe we could look for something else that might work in the cases where it's really difficult. I don't know if you thought at all about that sort of aspect of it.
I was looking more in terms of, we'll see what the sort of in-progress best practice thinking on how to draft disclosure requirements looks like, and then how that plays out through the testing on individual standards. But I imagined it would be a clear and specific disclosure objective with then sort of indicators of the type of information that might meet the objective. And that's more what I was having in mind, what this might look like ultimately if you go down this route. So the objective is to help evaluate whether the objectives of the acquisition have been met, something along those lines, and whether it's then in effect reporting the acquiree as an individual segment for a certain period or providing other types of disclosure would depend on the facts and circumstances. But
so then perhaps we could include some discussion of approaches that might work in some cases and that might not work so well in others, and alternatives to try in different cases.
Perhaps.
When companies go around the world with their roadshows to impress on investors how valuable their company is, how can it be controversial to show the value of your company?
Not the company specifically.
Why don't they just show the value of the company? I think the market does that.
The value of the company is different to sign the statements with it.
People don't ask how much your credit card business is worth. Don't matter how much you're not selling that, you're not doing that.
I know.
It's not relevant for me.
Chris?
So picking up on a couple of themes that I thought Andrew nailed, was that we agree that it's good to actually separate out the two problems. So we think there's clearly a problem, which is how do I know whether this acquisition that I've done is actually a good acquisition and I should have done it, versus there's an impairment problem. and we just don't see that tracking goodwill on an acquisition-by-acquisition basis is actually going to be a helpful outcome. So we agree in principle with where you're trying to go with the two issues. In terms of what you actually need about the acquisition itself, I think there's some good starting points here, but again, I think if you're just honing in on goodwill and what happens after integration, I'm not sure that's where you're going to get your best evidence. It seems to me that when you go into these types of transactions, that there's a whole lot of assumptions that management makes about why that's a good acquisition, and that's a disclosure that the users actually want, and that what you're actually asking people then is report back against those assumptions. So have they actually been achieved or not? And I think if you did it at that sort of principle level, I think you're more likely to get the disclosures that people are actually looking for. And I think that was what you were trying to get at as well, in terms of if you've got those objectives, the integration issue shouldn't become such a problem, because if you thought it was such an important assumption that that's why you made the decision, then you should be tracking it. And then I think the next question is, well, how long do you track it? And again, I don't see 2 or 5 or 10 years. Again, one of the things I would be saying is tell us your assumption about how long you think the payback period is. And if you think it's 2 years, well, then that's the 2 years of disclosure. If you think it's 5 years, then it's 5 years of disclosures. Or you'd then have to say something about why, if at the end of 2 years you then said, well, it's too hard, here's our rationale. So that's the first problem in terms of your acquisition side. In terms of your impairment side, we've been doing some outreach with investors in Australia, and one of the things that they've been telling us that they see as critical is it's not just your assumptions that have gone into your methodology. So it's not just I've chosen a 3% growth rate or I've chosen a 10% discount rate. What they would find more useful is understanding why you've chosen those particular rates. So did you choose your 3% growth rate because that's the midpoint of a range that came from several indexes of growth in the sector, or what it might be? And if you put a little bit more heat on people as to where those assumptions have actually come from, I think we're going to end up with some better information. But again, we would like to see a full rethink of all the disclosures in the impairment standard, because at the moment it's a bit of a hodgepodge, and I'm a bit surprised in terms of the session that you're going to have this afternoon that IS 36 didn't turn up on one of those standards that needed to have some disclosures looked at. So I guess in summary what we're saying is happy in principle with where you're going, but we think some of the specifics that you're asking for are not going to get you what you want.
Noble.
Yes, thank you. All of the jurisdictions that have responded expressed their views that some or all of the disclosures proposed may provide useful information. However, 4 of these jurisdictions had some reservations. I have 3 points. The first is that 2 jurisdictions noted that there were practical issues, including audit and compliance issues, regarding the disclosures of tracking information of the performance target originated from subjective assumptions and judgments. The second point is that 3 jurisdictions emphasize that post-acquisition integration could make it difficult to track and isolate the information separately for each acquired business. And these jurisdictions thought that some disclosures, including the breakdown of goodwill and the amount of revenue and operating profit of the acquired business, might not be possible to provide. The third point is that one jurisdiction mentioned that the benefits of these disclosures might not overweigh the costs for preparers of financial statements. Regarding the ideas about other possible disclosures, there were 2 suggestions. One suggestion from 2 jurisdictions was that there should be disclosures of the rationale or inputs into the assumptions which management used to perform the impairment testing of goodwill. The other suggestion by one jurisdiction was that considering disclosures which reflected the concept of the subsequent cash flow test, which the ISB rejected when revising IS 36 in 2003. Lastly, there were some jurisdictions who noted that disclosure only will not solve the too little, too late issue, and therefore these disclosures should be considered in combination with the accounting model. Thank you.
Thank you, Hans. Two points to be mentioned in terms of what is highly critical from a disclosure point of view. The first one is we think it's very important to have a clear picture of how a business, an acquired business, is going to be integrated into the existing operations of the acquirer. In other words, in certain cases it remains independent, in which case it's easier to track down, but in a very important number of cases it's combined, and the conditions of combination, operational combination, are extremely critical in terms of the outcome to follow up the goodwill. Therefore, this integration for us, from a strategic standpoint, should be disclosed on a regular basis in order to clarify the context of the follow-up of the goodwill. That's point number one. Point number two, in terms of, we recognize that disclosing the headroom is tricky, to say the least, because it might disclose a lot, though I would share Hans's view that in roadshows people are explaining how it works. So there is a balance here to obtain. However, I think the critical point is when, for some reason, you come close to the impairment. In other words, maybe you wouldn't require a disclosure of the headroom, but you would require a disclosure when the headroom becomes so thin that any change in the assumptions could take it to an impairment situation. Of course, it's a sensitive information, but that's precisely why it's important. So I think on this second topic that we should, to a certain extent, require when either a stress test or a change, a minor change in assumptions could trigger an impairment, and the reasons why it has not been done or it's being done. Thank you.
Andreas?
Thanks, Hans. Not to repeat what was said that I agree with, just to add one further point. I think with all the disclosures, we need to bear in mind that the bigger the company or the group, the higher the likelihood that there will be multiple successive transactions. And obviously that is a complicating factor. So it may not just be successive acquisitions, it may be divestments, it may be reorganizations, and then the question obviously becomes as to what is it that I'm actually supposed to track. Further, I think all the questions that have rightly been raised as to could you please explain how this acquisition works, you could equally just demand of companies that are growing organically. Yeah. So I wonder how much of that is actually a discussion about general business strategy, and probably something that be better parked in an MD&A analysis rather than in a specific note disclosure.
Tommaso?
I also share the questions expressed by Andrew before about disclosure, especially on the disclosure about recoverable amount of entities, of CGUs. Going through the disclosures, this paper, I noted, as Chris did, that one information could be useful for users is the payback period of the investment. That could be really useful for users, I understood, for stewardship purposes, no? To understand what is the period in which you think, the management thinks, that there could be a return over its investment. I think that the other side of the coin is that for steward purposes, for stewardship purposes, if I need the payback period, I would need also to know the disaggregation of goodwill during the time, because if I want to know what is the period of payback, I want to be able to track, to measure, to measure the way the management manages the business. So I appreciate that this disclosure is on the list, and I think that however, I also share the view, the suggestion to make some cost benefits analysis about it, because it could be very costly to track goodwill over the time.
Can I ask a question? Can I ask Nick a question? Following on from a couple of comments that have been made, including from Tomasa. So a couple of people have mentioned interest in the payback period, which to me is how quickly I manage to recover my investment. And I know in the past we've talked about whether we think it's people are interested in the payback period or the period of time over which they think they're going to get the benefits that meant that they wanted to pay a premium, if you like. The goodwill. Do you have a view on whether it's the payback period we should be interested in, or the period over which you think these sort of incremental benefits are going to arise?
I mean,
or is it both? I don't know.
I look at it on the totality, and I guess many investors were thinking about it in terms of what is the medium return on the capital that's been deployed. And so you could express that as a payback period, and obviously that will give you a time horizon around how soon you reach your cost of capital. Really, but that's, yeah, it's the same question. So it is a totality. What capital has been deployed here? What's the cost of any restructuring? What working capital benefits might there be? And what kind of return are we going to get on that?
I mean, I understood talking with stakeholders in the past that one of the information the management need to know at any time it makes an investment, a business combination, is to explain in what is the period in which they think they can pay back their investment made. So, and I think from a user perspective, I would like to know this information.
Yeah.
To measure whether, you know.
It's another way of expressing the same thing.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. I just thought that perhaps I might be interested both in. So say that I managed to buy something at a really good price, as in the cheapest price I could get it at, I might have a very short payback period because I might be able to recover my investment very quickly, but I could still get, you know, really great benefits that go on much beyond that because it's a great acquisition.
Yep.
And I could see arguments for why I might be interested actually in both pieces of information.
Right. Yeah.
And in fact, when we had that discussion with the CMAC, a lot of them, some of them were talking about disclosure of a useful life if you had amortization, because they saw it as information about a payback period, and they did express it as payback period rather than useful life, and we questioned them on it at the time. But.
And I'd like to add,
Peter, what was the relation with amortization?
They saw, we were talking about whether you find amortization useful, whether you find impairment useful, yeah. And some of them said that they would find amortization useful, but one of the reasons they thought they might find it useful was because you'd be disclosing the amortization period, mm-hmm. and some of them saw that as some sort of proxy for a payback period.
That would mean that if you had a really fantastic investment where you recovered everything in 1 year, you've got to write all your goodwill off in 1 year, even though you might get benefits for 20 years.
Well, I suppose it would be the other way around, that if you think it's a fantastic investment, you would amortize it over 20 years instead of over one.
That's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah.
To make sure
it would have to be inverse.
And I'd like to add one comment from Patrick's feedback about disclosing the headroom. Because current IAS 36 already required the disclosure of the headroom only when a reasonably possible change in key assumption would cause the unit carrying amount exceeds the recovery amount. So the reason we suggest this disclosure is to disclosing this headroom every year, because trend in the headroom can provide useful information to users.
Lim?
In general, we support the enhanced disclosure on backgrounds of the acquisition pricing and comparison of actual performance with targets. But having said that, some of the information might be sensitive and classified and difficult to be verified. So we suggest to solicit views from preparers and other stakeholders as well. And we don't object to break down information of the goodwill of past business combinations. For companies with a large amount of combinations, it can be costly. So materiality and cost benefit should be considered. And on the headroom disclosure, since we really do not agree with the approach, and we also think that the disclosure can be challenging.
Alexandru?
Frank, just with some background here before going to the three questions. The main comment here is that we are talking about diverse economic phenomena here. It's just not acquisition and goodwill as a whole. There are different things going on. And just to split in two categories, one is when you buy, take for example, a retailer that buy a different brand, that sells different product, and pretty much keeps that brand operate independently. That, and there are some cost synergies, but there is a business there operating independent for some years. And that's a different story. For example, when you buy a credit card business and you just merge it with your own other businesses, and the brand doesn't the brand ceases to exist, you're pretty much buying the client bases and etc. So just put the two extremes here and to orientate the discussion. So in page 8, the reasons for paying a premium that exceeds the value, I believe that's really important. And actually, you already had to do that. To the board, you have to do that to our shareholders, you have to talk to investors. So I mean, it's going to be weird if a company cannot justify what's going on and why it paid the premium. So that's a pretty much information that everybody, at least from my jurisdiction, agreed that should be disclosed. But the there are more reservations on page 12 about the revenue operating profit of the acquired business. Because that could be potentially misleading. And I use the credit card example here, because if I buy a credit card business and the profit of the credit card business is X, but actually I'm not buying because of the credit card business, because I'm going to sell insurance to those clients. So if I only look at the profit of the acquired business, I'm actually giving information that's potentially misleading. Because, of course, there are other revenues that come from my existing business to those existing clients. So, this is something that must be taken into account. So it's much more complex to get information about headroom for this business, because the business as it is has ceased to exist. So that's much more support for the reasons for paying and have a good explanation and then following it against KPIs, because you can have KPIs. So how many clients are going to migrate? How long does it take to migrate the clients to your systems? So, and not that much support for page 12.
Nick?
Okay, yeah, just to respond to that, I think that's an acceptable observation, very much acceptable, but I think often these disclosures operate in combination. So I understand what the base level of profitability in terms of the business that I'm acquiring, and then I want to start thinking about the synergies that you may disclose in terms of the reason for paying premium. And that helps me build up an overall picture, you know, in terms of what the payback period may be, or am I going to get a reasonable return? So I think it's from a user point of view, I would look at these in combination in terms of the information they're providing, rather than think about them in isolation. I think that in that respect, then I'd start to understand that actually this is about selling insurance, and that would be disclosed, and then I could build on the
information. I absolutely agree. I'm just saying that that's going to be very difficult. I mean, Ms. Lynch will say the performance of the acquired business is that, because I don't care actually about the performance of the acquired business. I care about the performance of the acquired business integrated with my...
So it will vary from business to business. Some may have a reasonable amount of operating profit to begin with. Others may not have anything. Yeah. I can then layer on synergies that come through the business combination, and then I still start to build up a picture. Is this a good transaction or not?
Christine?
It wasn't entirely clear to me that everybody is going to view or understand what the difference is between the reasons for paying for reasons for paying premium compared to the current requirement to disclose the qualitative factors that make up goodwill. So I think what the distinction there might need to be clarified, because it seems that those qualitative factors are already required. And I think that the disclosures to be really meaningful to a user, you're potentially going to bump up against pushback from preparers that they're going to be providing information that's proprietary and competitively sensitive. And their reaction to that, if they're required to do this, will then be to go to a boilerplate sort of approach to the disclosure. So I think that there's that concern, and if you go down this path, trying to figure out how to word it in such a way to circumvent or mitigate that risk would be important. The disclosures regarding the comparison of actual performance with those of targets or assumptions, it says each year, so I wasn't sure if, you know, if the goodwill stays there indefinitely, does that mean every year indefinitely, or what the time period would be on that. And I'll just echo the concerns of some others about the integration and the ability to actually track that separately from the other businesses that it's integrated into. On the point of disclosing the information about the headroom, I think it was Andrew that mentioned this concern that potentially that might lead to disclosing the value of either the entire business or components of the business. And I'd just like to point out that in the conceptual framework, of course, it says specifically that that is not the purpose of financial statements. That's a really important part, I think, of the conceptual framework, because there is a risk that if the company were to say our value is X, that would become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it is not the purpose of financial statements to dictate to the market the value of the firm. So I think that has some potential negative consequences that could come with it. And then last but not least, on the other disclosures, I think for those who might believe that goodwill is a wasting element of the financial statements and would want to relieve the balance sheet over time for that amount that's sitting there, having the information regarding the carrying amount of each chunk of goodwill, along with payback period was mentioned, I think in response to Sue's comment, which I thought was a really good one, weighted average useful life of the identifiable assets might give a period of time over which the cash flows are sort of expected to be generated from the assets that were acquired. And so that might be another way of thinking about that time period over which those who wish to amortize goodwill could restate the financial statements to do so.
I'm curious. I'm just curious. Your views on page slide 16, the other possible disclosure staff are considering, especially the disclosure of total net assets less goodwill. As Christine mentioned, goodwill in itself is a wasting asset. So the goodwill in itself cannot be an asset if there is no other asset. So it's not really standalone asset. It's an asset as a definition. However, it could be wasted. So therefore, having a large amount of goodwill may indicate that that company have overly investing. So therefore, requiring disclosure of total net assets less goodwill may indicate some useful information. And that this is not costly. There is already the number of goodwill and net assets. Just provide the deducted amount, simply. So do you think it's useful or it's nonsense?
Is this by segment?
Oh,
for the whole entity, it's just a calculation a user can do rather straightforwardly for themselves, isn't it?
That's what people do.
The question is whether they do.
If they want to, they could.
Oh, yes.
I think the thinking behind this idea was to sort of make sure that investors are aware of the amount of value, I guess, on the balance sheet that's attributable to goodwill, which is a got more measurement uncertainty, perhaps a softer number than other numbers. That was the sort of logic behind it.
And
because it can disappear.
You say that everybody does it, but it's not true. I mean, there's a lot of automated trading going on, which is based on book value as it is. That doesn't make any distinction whether it's a trip.
So everyone could do it if they felt it was important information.
You can. But, you know, there was recently a company in the UK went under, and a lot of people were surprised to see, oh, gee, if you subtracted goodwill, there was nothing left in equity. And I am not so convinced that all these sort of investors are so sophisticated and that they look through these numbers. So it could be like a reality check. Be aware that, you know, if you look through the numbers and subtract goodwill, this is what is left in terms of value.
I just want to ask a question. So I'm intrigued by the improvements to the disclosure requirements for IFRS 8, because there is a correlation there. I mean, what it sounds like you're trying to achieve from a disclosure perspective, you want to hold management accountable, saying, here's what you said you were going to try to achieve strategically by doing this acquisition, and how has that played out? I mean, big picture, that's what it sounds like you're trying to achieve. And because the CGUs flow from the segments, so I'm kind of intrigued by what your thinking was with regard to that, just trying to tie them together. That's a question.
do you want me to jump in on that one?
Jump in.
Yeah, okay. So that's exactly what the thinking was behind it. So if you think about it, if one of the concerns with the current goodwill impairment test is that it's providing information too late, so you have confirmatory value, then what can you get to provide information earlier that's more predictive in nature? And so exactly as you said, well, if the CGUs flow from the segments, not suggesting that we need to have disclosures at the CGU level, but perhaps some disclosure at the operating segment level or reportable segment level could then provide some of that predictive information. So what more is there that might help solve some of the goodwill impairment questions?
That has some merit to go a little further with that.
Sorry, in what way would you go further? You'd take it to the CGUs? Or?
No. What would that look like and maybe some kind of brainstorming with some users and preparers about where that would go? Because, I mean, it seems like if you're going to say for every acquisition you've ever done, you've got to report this, this, and this every year, you're taking a sledgehammer and you're trying to just drive it at that level as opposed to what is the information you really need to ensure the accountability and transparency, which is basically what you're after, I think.
So I think one thing that's been talked about is, could you disclose total assets by segment? Could that be a requirement? And you could track, you know, where there are low returns and high returns. Did that did that time with acquisitions, for instance?
Chang Wu.
Thank you. This is not an easy issue. However, Christine, you suggested a very interesting idea on based on your idea on the conceptual framework of financial statements. Maybe this disclosure might not be consistent with that framework. So could you elaborate your idea a little more on why this is inconsistent?
Yeah, so the purpose of the financial statements is to really help users to figure out the value of the entity. And one of the concerns is that if you put a number out there in the marketplace, so if management says, based on all the information we have, we believe our company is worth $1 million, let's just say for argument's sake, then depending on what type of investor is trading on that information, you may have enough investors that I would call them lazy, that would just say, oh,
the company is worth $1 million, so they all jump in, and if it rises up to $1 million, and then trading stops essentially at that point until a new disclosure comes out. There is some evidence in research of analysts herding around the information that management provides, that reducing the amount of variability in their forecast, which sounds like a good thing, but it can also result in less information getting impounded in stock price, which makes the market less informationally efficient. And so that's why I think that part of the conceptual framework that says that financial reports are really not designed to report that value, but simply to help the marketplace gather another source of information for them to try to process, is really very important. And I would feel that disclosure would be very contrary to the conceptual framework and potentially have some negative ramifications.
And?
Back on the operating segments, I just wanted to follow up on a couple of comments that were made in response to Linda. And it was through the CMAC group, through the analyst group, that some of them suggested that, you know, you're going after this impairment stuff, but you could do something else instead. So it is about a difficult problem that we're struggling with and not advancing. And the suggestion was, as Nick has summarised, you know, to look at something else, which would be by segment, total assets. And this particular person wanted total liabilities as well, though I know Nick's got some queries about that. But it was about trying to come at the problem from a different way to give them the information they're looking for. So it is your point about what the objective is. So.
Tommaso?
I would like to make an additional comment. I think we have talked about disclosure of goodwill, but when we talk about goodwill, we probably all have in mind what in IFRS 3 is defined as core goodwill. However, I remember in EFRAG we have some debate about what are the components of the accounting goodwill, and I remember a very well done study made by the staff that highlighted that on average 30% of goodwill is just a consequence of accounting mismatch, so mainly because of deferred tax liability recognized at the so-called nominal amount, and as a counterpart goodwill is recognized. I wonder whether, I mean, to me, this is just what's in other maybe projects we would call an accounting mismatch. To me, this part of goodwill, this issue should be dealt in a way or another. I would like to ask you whether you're going to consider it, or whether it could be useful to make some disclosure about it. I mean, you can deal with the disclosure or another way around.
The short answer to that is I don't think we have investigated it in this project so far, and at the moment we haven't got plans to do it, but we'll regroup after this meeting and who knows, that might change. But there was a comment I nearly made yesterday, actually, in business combinations under common control, and the sensitivity that was felt around the table about under or overpayment and labelling something as an under or overpayment. And I wonder whether part of that sensitivity... And people seem to accept the idea that if there's a clear under or overpayment and it might be unusual circumstances, we should probably think about doing something with that. But I wonder whether some of that sensitivity might be that there might be some sort of artificial underpayment or overpayment that's generated by some of the sort of accounting mismatches you're talking about. And so I think it is something we should probably at least think about to some extent. We haven't
think
done so far.
For impairment purposes, you don't recognize the one loss because you net the deferred tax liability with that.
Right.
And then after years, so you regenerate your goodwill with internally generated ones. So.
Okay. I think we've come to...
Should I attempt a summary?
Well, yes.
Good luck.
You're listening.
Yeah, you can give me the medals afterwards. So the first thing I heard was we need to be very clear about objectives, and there are a couple of different objectives going on, and we probably ought to try and keep them separate to some extent to make sure we focus on the right thing. So one is disclosure about the assumptions and targets at the date of the acquisition, and what was the subsequent performance, and did things pan out as you expected? And then secondly, there's assumptions about, or there's the impairment side of it, and things related to whether the impairment test is working properly and such like. But on the assumptions and targets, what I sensed was that most people thought it's worth pursuing that idea and looking at that to some extent. I guess one caution that came out from quite a few people was that it's going to be sensitive information. It's going to be interesting, but it's also going to be sensitive, and people will feel it's proprietary. A result of that is there's a high risk probably of just getting boilerplate. And so if we do go down that path, we'll need to think about how to avoid that. We heard some concerns about integration. I'll come back to integration in a second, but there were some concerns about integration. I don't think they're quite as strong here in this part of it as they were in the impairment part of it. And I think the reason they weren't so strong here was that when you were planning to do the acquisition, if you're going to integrate, you'll have already thought about that to some extent, presumably. And so there's some sort of interaction probably between assumptions and targets. And so there might be some reasonable way of dealing with that to some extent, at least. One thing I heard from a couple of people was, and it's something that I shared to some extent myself, is a concern about how much of this is demand for information just about acquisitions, and how much is a demand for information about any business that the company owns, internally generated or one that's acquired, and is it necessarily right to require a different level of information in the two situations? And something else I heard was maybe a hint that some of this might actually be more management commentary, perhaps, than financial statements. That might also be, particularly in the kind of assumptions and targets area, and sort of tracking. We don't normally make people disclose outcomes against budget, so do we necessarily want to do that in acquisitions? On the impairment side, I think the biggest single story I heard about that really was the integration problem. I think virtually everybody who talked about that talked about the integration problem, and it's a difficult one to crack, I think. Although, as I hinted in my brief exchange with Andrew, I think we shouldn't necessarily give up on a disclosure there if it fails in the cases where there's integration. If it would give you useful information when you don't have the integration problems, maybe it's worth pursuing in those cases to some extent. On the headroom approach, there seems to be fairly widespread concern that it's probably a bit inconsistent, really, with the objective of financial statements. It's coming too close to disclosing the value of the business, perhaps even the value of the segment or the entity as a whole. And so we should be cautious about that. And, of course, the concerns about sensitivity and proprietary information seem particularly strong with that piece as well. Were there things I missed in that summary? Or
okay, well, that was very well done, Peter.
Yeah.